Chapter 3. War and Culture. The 16th century Jesuit Louis Froche described the pirate lord Noshima Murakami as being so powerful that on these coasts, as well as the coastal regions of other kingdoms, all pay him annual tribute out of fear that he will destroy them. His ships continually flew across the sea. Noshima, like other 16th-century warlords, no longer depended on patronage from Kyoto aristocrats to secure wealth, power, and influence. During early warrior history, the centers of power in Kyoto and Kamakura loomed large in the lives of many warriors across Japan, but from the 14th to the 16th centuries, there was a gradual shift to regional networks, culminating in a century of war in which the bottom overtook the top, Gekko-Kujo. Warfare was endemic during the 3 centuries after the fall of the Kamakura shogunate and the Hojo family in 1331, which affected the relationship between aristocrats and warriors and the nature of warrior wealth and power. Yet, counterintuitively, at the most violent moments in history, warrior support and participation in the art world was also at its height. The 16th-century conqueror Oda Nobunaga burned down Buddhist temples and slaughtered thousands of lay supporters, but he also studied no theater, performing parts of the play Atsumori before embarking on the Battle of Okehazama. The Kyoto Problem. The first crack in Hojo power since the Jokyu War, 1221, coincided with the rise of yet another emperor, Go Daigo, who plotted against the Hojo as Go Toba did in 1221. Go Daigo became emperor as a stopgap between the death of the previous emperor, his half-brother, and the ascension of the next one. Unlike those other emperors, however, he was an adult, not an easily controlled child, and he was surrounded by advisors who could support his political aspirations. Not only did he refuse to step down as emperor, which he, the shogunate, and the nobility had agreed would be the case, but he even installed his own son as the next emperor in order to maintain control of Kyoto. He gathered a wide range of supporters, claimed suzerainty over all warriors, and, in 1331, issued a call to arms against the shogunate. The Hojo quickly put an end to this, exiled him, and purged many of his supporters. Still, not everyone abandoned Go Daigo's cause. His general, Kusunoki Masashige, kept organizing sympathetic warriors not connected to the shogunate. Go Daigo promised them titles and wealth, just as Yoritomo had done more than a century earlier. Annoyed but confident, the Hojo sent another army led by Ashikaga Takauji, the newly ascended 28-year-old head of the Ashikaga clan, longtime powerful Hojo allies. Instead of fighting Go Daigo's army, he attacked the shogunate's headquarters in Kyoto. Another Hojo ally, the Nitta clan, similarly rebelled against the Hojo in the east. For the first time since the late 12th century, an emperor finally succeeded in ruling without having to share power with a warrior regime. But Go Daigo could not celebrate for long. For 3 years, from 1333 to 1336, he took control of the shogunate's prerogatives, becoming the sole authority to guarantee warrior appointments and land claims. Meanwhile, however, Takauji's influence grew, and Go Daigo failed to restrain him. Takauji gathered warriors loyal to him as he fought his way to Kamakura to put down a Hojo resurgence there, and then he fought more enemies on his return trip to Kyoto. Meanwhile, Kyoto erupted in violence. An anonymous author posted complaints about the political situation in Kyoto by the Nijo riverbed. Things common in the capital these days are night attacks, robbers, counterfeit edicts, criminals, fast horses, to indicate trouble in some place, random fighting, severed heads. Like Taira Kiyomori centuries before, Takauji placed his own candidate on the throne in Kyoto, and he began building what would become known as the Muromachi shogunate, 1336 to 1573, named after the district in Kyoto that became the center of his regime. Go Daigo established his own court just 50 miles south of Kyoto in Yoshino, where he died peacefully. Heirs from both sides fought each other until 1392, when the Yoshino line was crushed, but not forgotten. At the end of World War II, one man claimed to be descended from the southern court and demanded that he replace the northern imposter, Hirohito. The new Ashikaga shogunate depended upon regional warrior families to govern. On the southwest island of Kyushu, where the Mongols tried to invade, military governors essentially ruled as they saw fit. Likewise, in the east, around Kamakura, the Ashikaga had to delegate authority to warriors who declared loyalty to them. Though they were never completely independent of shogunal authority, these governors nonetheless gradually assumed rights that their Kamakura predecessors never had, levying taxes, judging and enforcing laws without consulting the shogunate, and collecting fees from local plaintiffs to carry out sentences. With greater revenue, military governors built armies larger than those of the governors of the Kamakura period. Still, not all land in Japan was under the jurisdiction of a military governor. Local strongmen, those not subsumed under the shogunate's bureaucratic purview, also controlled territory. Since many military governors lived in Kyoto and left their provinces to be managed by underlings, strongmen either sought an official title from the shogunate or simply forced the governor to recognize their dominance in the region. The shift to local concerns happened gradually throughout the 15th century. For men like the pirate Noshima, regional networks, concerns, and sources of wealth mattered more than ties to the political center in Kyoto. This is the origin of those who would become known as the great names, daimyo, the warlords of the 16th century. Tools of warfare. Long before movies depicted samurai wielding lightsaber-sharp swords or charging into battle on mighty horses, warriors themselves enjoyed fantastical descriptions of warrior combat. Warriors and non-warriors alike read, listened to, and watched performances of war tales, a genre of writing that had existed since at least the 13th century. Historians have cautioned against accepting these tales as accurate portrayals of historical events, but even history textbooks tend to include these problematic literary descriptions of early samurai warfare. The most persistent myth is the belief that warriors announced their family lineages before engaging in battle. It has a wonderful cinematic appeal, but is not backed up by historical evidence, and military historians no longer accept it as established practice. A contemporary account of the Mongol invasions describes Japanese warriors who actually tried this, only to be laughed at by the Mongol troops. But these warriors might have simply imitated the heroics described in war tales, in the same way that Japanese mafioso, yakuza, imitate the clothing style featured in Japanese gangster movies. Nevertheless, warfare was not only about combative effectiveness. Warriors might ignore orders or even target an ally if they felt offended. Warriors painted and decorated their armor not to intimidate, but to be noticed as crowds gathered to watch battles unfold. In these battles, killing a lowly rank-and-file soldier did not earn as many accolades as defeating an elite or well-known warrior. In the skirmish tactics of pre-15th century warfare, some verbal exchanges might have occurred, but that was certainly not the norm. Early warfare involved armies that were small in comparison to the large-scale warfare of the Warring States era, 1477 to 1590. Samurai vassals might have up to a few dozen men they could bring into battle, but many had only a handful. They could draw on local men as temporary retainers, and by joining forces with other vassals who served an aristocratic warrior, such as Yoritomo, an army could be as small as a few hundred or as many as a few thousand. The first major war, the Genpei War, might have involved several thousand to an unlikely 40,000 troops depending on the historical source. Given the Genpei War's broad geographical range and the presence of defenses that changed the landscape, like trenches, it is likely that non-warriors participated as well. Kamakura period combat was conducted among warriors on horseback, accompanied by men on foot, who either fought each other or attempted to unseat mounted warriors. This might seem like an unlikely technique if one imagines the size and speed of modern horses charging through enemy armies. Even Japanese tourists are fascinated by heart-racing demonstrations of mounted shooting, yabusame, at shrines around Japan. The archers stand tall above the crowd, galloping at full speed without holding the reins as they shoot at a series of wooden plank targets. But the pre-modern reality is a bit less dramatic. Medieval horses in Japan were about the size of a pony, and with an armored man on top, they were hardly fast or durable. Nonetheless, throughout much of pre-modern Japanese history, the bow and arrow, not the sword, was the primary weapon of choice for elite warriors. Mounted archery was so common that the phrase "the way of the horse and bow," Kyuba no Michi, referred to military arts in general. On the early skirmish-style battlefield, shooting it out against other mounted warriors or picking off footmen were common methods of conducting warfare. Reward petitions and battlefield reports indicate which kinds of weapons were the deadliest. Arrows accounted for most injuries and fatalities up to the 14th century. One shot alone usually did not kill warriors, especially wealthier men who could afford decent armor. Not only did the armor itself stop many arrows, but a blanket-like cloth that billowed behind a warrior's armor as he rode away from the enemy could make targeting him difficult by partly obscuring his outline, and it also stopped some of an arrow's momentum. However, with only primitive battlefield medicine, even a stray shot or an unfortunately lodged arrow withdrawn in the wrong way resulted in a slow, sometimes painful death as a warrior bled out. Swords are another source of fascination for modern audiences, supposedly representing the soul of the samurai and so sharp that they could cut with just a touch. But the sword was merely a sidearm until the 14th century, and even then it was used only to gain advantage over an enemy during close-range combat, to finish off a downed opponent, or to decapitate him for later reward. The prototypical sword seen in popular culture was a later invention. Before the Mongol invasions, swords were heavy and had long blades used to attack a horse's leg like a large cleaver. Momentum and weight gave these early swords brute bludgeoning force, making sharpness less important. Extant battle reports and archaeological finds show crushed skulls to be the typical sword fatalities during the medieval period, not subtly delivered cuts to vital arteries. Besides the iconic sword and bow, weapons included pikes, also referred to as spears, halberds, crossbows, shields, battle axes, large mallets, long rake-like weapons known as bear claws, and even rocks. Crossbows were common in Chinese armies, and one might expect to find them in Japan. They existed, but perhaps because of their limitations such as slow rate of fire and limited trajectory, they never became popular. Mention of a large crossbow, possibly mounted on a turret called a great bow, oyumi, appears in ancient texts, but no artifacts or even illustrations exist. The traditional story of how guns came to Japan begins with a Portuguese ship blown by storms onto a small island called Tanegashima. In 1543, so the story goes, the lord of the island realized the importance of the ship's guns and ordered local craftsmen to reverse engineer them, thus starting a domestic gun-making industry just as the demand for guns spiked during a time of national war. Military historians in Japan have noted that primitive harquebuses, early matchlock guns with ball ammunition loaded from the front, entered Japan as early as the mid-15th century from Okinawa, Southeast Asia, and China. The Europeans did not introduce arms to Japan, but they brought large quantities and probably better quality weapons during the latter half of the 16th century. Guns could make the difference in battle, although they did not change the essential nature or tactics of warfare in Japan. The biggest myth told about guns in Japan is that the samurai eventually abandoned them in favor of the sword because the sword was more honorable and represented the soul of the samurai. This is simply not true. First, people continued to use guns in the few small-scale battles and uprisings during the otherwise peaceful era that followed the Warring States period. Lords gave them as gifts, and commoners and warriors alike used guns in hunting and for recreation. From the 17th to the early 19th centuries, cannons positioned at Japan's largest port, Nagasaki, were equivalent to those used in Europe. And samurai used guns against Chinese accused of smuggling in the southern port of Nagasaki. Thus, warriors never gave up guns, they still used them, but the opportunities to use them dwindled after the Warring States period. The archetypical samurai armor has a long history, but like weapons, it changed over time. Armor from the Kamakura period, 1180 to 1333, consisted of pieces of lacquered wood woven together with some metal reinforcement on the chest. It covered most of the body except for the face, but did not protect the extremities well. This type of full armor was expensive, and most foot soldiers wore nothing more than basic armor that covered the torso. Chainmail, like the European version but made with smaller chains, was used from the 14th century onward and was combined with an older style of armor made of metal plates. Helmets varied depending on the status of the warrior. They were made from a range of materials that included iron, steel, metal plates riveted together, and hardened leather for common soldiers. Armor changed to reflect shifts in battle tactics, especially during the 15th and 16th centuries, when war was conducted at a much larger scale, with better organized units of men attacking with pikes, volleys of arrows, and guns. Immaculately preserved armor can be found in museums throughout North America and Europe, but most of these pieces date to the 17th through 19th centuries, when there was little warfare, and armor was either worn in warrior processions or simply displayed in the home, seeing no combat at all. There are occasional echoes of European influence in Japanese armor, such as helmets shaped like those worn by European counterparts, but those are rare. Japanese warriors did not use European-style single-handed shields. Japanese shields were typically as tall as a man and were made of wood. They often included a stand so that a line of men could move and place them side by side to create a movable wall. Often these were impromptu defenses of opportunity. Wooden doors, portions of walls, or tatami woven flooring ripped from buildings during battle. And what of castles? There are two issues that might disappoint. First, castles, as Westerners imagine them, with moats and walls surrounding a central keep, were a relatively late development in Japanese history, dating to the 16th century at the earliest. Some castles supposedly have earlier origins, but those were rebuilt several times after the Warring States era. During earlier times, such as the Genpei War, some fortifications existed, but nothing grand or permanent. Warriors who served the Kamakura shogunate might have had a large compound with walls and several buildings at most. Since many warriors worked as managers, police, and governors, there was little need to build large structures. Even Yoritomo's Kamakura Palace, which housed many of the shogunate's offices, no longer exists. Only in the 16th century did the Japanese build castles designed to keep an enemy out and to confound him should he penetrate the outer defenses. Despite the stylistic difference with European castles, they shared many features: moats, sturdily built narrow gates to keep enemies from flooding in, and small windows that allowed warriors to shoot arrows or pour boiling liquid onto intruding forces. The biggest difference between European and Japanese castles was the walls. Although their construction changed to accommodate the introduction of guns into Japan, these walls nonetheless did not suffer from punishing artillery-led sieges as did their European counterparts. The greatest threat to the integrity of Japanese walls was earthquakes. To provide some protection from them, the walls were not built vertically straight using stones stuck together with mortar. Instead, Japanese walls had a slight curve, and builders cut and stacked stones to fit perfectly, filling gaps with smaller stones without the need for mortar. Although there are many castles throughout Japan today, only a dozen of them have keeps older than 100 years. Keeps rarely served a military function. They were used mostly to project authority across the landscape. Fires throughout the Tokugawa period, 1600 to 1868, destroyed many keeps and other wooden structures such as watchtowers or guard posts. Since keeps look impressive, they have been added to castles that never originally featured one. Local politicians have realized that castles are big tourist attractions and symbols of civic pride. Most of the castles in Japan are post-World War II fabrications that accompanied the post-war economic boom. Some of the reconstructions are inaccurately built or use too much concrete, giving castles a shiny but inauthentic look. The most authentic castle is probably Himeji Castle, a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Himeji survived the fate suffered by other castles that were either torn down after the Meiji Restoration, 1868, and sold for scrap, destroyed by natural disasters, or bombed by the United States during World War II. However, even Himeji has undergone repairs and has been criticized by some as being much whiter than it would have been before the 20th century. Nonetheless, Himeji is considered the archetypal Japanese castle, and many castle reconstructions have been modeled after Himeji, regardless of the historical differences. The warrior in combat. For much of Japanese history, compensation was the key to obtaining service from warriors. Yoritomo's success hinged on his ability to reward allies. The Hojos lost support when they could not deliver enough rewards to those who fought the Mongols, and Emperor Go Daigo was able to buy samurai away from the last enemy general who tried to fight him in 1333. So, how did warriors prove their service? By submitting reports and petitions for rewards and collecting evidence, namely, heads. Taking heads had its origins in police duties. Early warrior violence primarily involved chasing down criminals and decapitating them to prove that the execution had been carried out. Heads would be collected, tagged, and publicly exhibited around Kyoto. During larger battles, headhunting functioned as a way for warriors to record their achievements and thus receive payment for their service. Heads would be cleaned and displayed on a board for a general to examine. Well-known enemies earned them the highest rewards, but differentiating middle- and lower-ranking warriors could be trickier. Prisoners helped identify heads. Heads from common soldiers were typically ignored. The downside of beheading an enemy during battle is obvious. A warrior could be killed while taking a head. Some generals solved this problem by issuing cut-and-toss orders, which tended to rely on eyewitness accounts of the beheading, thus skipping the collection side of the process. Warriors also gamed the system by scouring the battlefield for wounded men who were not yet dead, beheading non-combatants, forging or switching nameplates, and looking for abandoned heads, activities that were deemed unseemly and worthy of ridicule. No notions of honor, rooted in maintaining a reputation, trumped the desire to emerge victorious. There were no written codes of conduct, no tactics deemed unacceptable. These included arson, which killed indiscriminately, and ambushes and night attacks when the enemy was caught unaware. Trickery, particularly clever trickery, could earn a warrior praise, such as the following from a 16th century military chronicle titled The Military Mirror of Kai. During the Battle of Toishi Kuzure, there was an enemy separated from his comrades and armed with a long spear. When Imai chased after him, the enemy, a warrior of the warlord Uesugi Kenshin, changed the position of his spear and was going to strike Imai from his horse. Because the enemy was walking, he could move about freely, but Imai was on a horse and could not. Imai, famed warrior that he was, tricked his opponent by calling out to him as if he were an ally. As the enemy lowered his spear to greet him, Imai's men moved in to attack. Imai is a martial expert, even though he was not adept with a sword and did not know much about martial arts. There are few details about how warriors trained together in groups during the Kamakura period, but we know that training was a social activity that helped develop some degree of group identity. During the Kamakura period, men used hunting as an opportunity to learn group coordination. Warrior managers on estates had portions of land reserved for hunting or falconry, which helped warriors learn how to survey terrain. Ceremonial shooting from horseback began among warriors in Kyoto in the 11th century at the latest, but the tactic is often associated with Kamakura, where Yoritomo held shooting events at large shrines. Dog shooting was another activity that was recreational, social, and useful for military preparedness. Professional dog handlers kept and released dogs into an enclosed area while warriors shot at them from horseback with blunted arrows. Training and ritual often occurred in Buddhist and Shinto spaces, and thus warfare and religion intertwined. Buddhist temples and Shinto shrines wielded political, military, and economic power. They possessed land, collected taxes, lent money with interest rates as high as 300%, and provided protection for a variety of merchant guilds, including alcohol, sake, and weapon production. The notion that there were white-scarfed warrior monks armed with glaives, naginata, derives mostly from art history, literature, and popular culture. However, monks whose previous career included military experience continued to fight on behalf of temples. Major temples could rely on lay supporters, sometimes retired warriors, who acted as an institution's muscle. They helped collect loans or protected the temples from bandits, pirates, and warriors who intruded on their estates. Religious institutions confronted their enemies with supernatural weapons. Prayers and chanting were more akin to spell casting than prostrations for good luck. Clerics expected to be rewarded for calling upon the gods and Buddhas for the divine winds that they claimed destroyed the invading Mongol forces. Warriors had Sanskrit words inscribed on their weapons and armor to protect them from harm. The invocations and imagery of esoteric Buddhism mattered more than Zen meditation to a warrior heading into combat. They read about, or learned from other warriors and monks, spells such as this one that told the chanter how to escape from an attack by fire. To escape from an enemy who attacks you with fire, face the direction of water, or at the sky, and chant, "Praise to the god of rain and water," 7 times. Then incant On Su'u Ruino Ten Sowaka and pour water down a bow from its top. Warriors also paid homage to divine beings associated with war. This included the Buddhist godlike Marishiten, who carried an assortment of weapons in her 6 hands while riding atop a wild boar, and Hachiman, another Buddhist god of war. Deities appeared in dreams and could portend positive results in war. Some warrior hegemons promoted their rule as divinely ordained, or were promoted as gods by their followers after death.